Can everybody hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay, good. All right. Thank you, Kimberly, for the introduction. I want to start by thanking Judy for allowing us to use her yard.
Yay!
Thank you. Thank you, Judy. So, turn it up a little? Okay. First of all, I'd like to see a show of hands of everybody that's already participating and doing the process in the Big Book Awakening. All right. So there's a few people here that aren't, and just they're curious or visiting. I was talking to Kimberly about this and thinking about what I should share today, and what came to me is you don't just need another AA pitch. Right, that may be what would be more interesting is to answer that question for you guys. Where did this all come from? Right, and I thought, well, they're giving me a lot of time to say that and to talk about where it all came from. So I thought that would be a great opportunity to really kind of dig in and just start from the beginning with the timeline. And one of the things that people have really seemed to appreciate is to be able to trace their lineage all the way back. So a lot of you are working with people that are working with people that are working with people here that are, we've got three, sometimes four generations of sponsorship here, right? But I think a lot of it kind of narrows down to just a couple people that are here. So I wanted to do this, and what I'm going to do is follow a timeline, and I'm going to actually start with Bill Wilson, all right, and bring it up to current, and then I'll talk about how the Big Book Awakening came about. How does that sound?
Right
on. All right. You guys know already a lot about Bill because you've read it in the books or you've, you know, heard other people talk about it. But in 1935, Bill Wilson went to Dr. Bob, and they had their first meeting at while Dr. Bob was still drinking. Right, Bill had just a couple months of sobriety at the time, 6 months actually, right, and felt that he was out of town, felt that he needed to talk to another alcoholic, and that was in 1935. And that was the spark that started Alcoholics Anonymous, that talk. And the three of those guys went on to talk to Alcoholics Anonymous member number three, Bill Dodson, in the hospital. But you can read all of that in the Big Book. You know, I thought that maybe what would be more interesting is what you're not going to see just in the Big Book. And so I want to roll it forward a year to 1936. In 1936, a year after that initial meeting between Bill and Bob, another guy came into the picture. His name was Paul Stanley. Right? Paul Stanley was an insurance guy, and he was certainly having a lot of trouble with drinking, and he actually had his first contact with Dr. Bob around January of 1936. He didn't actually start to get sober till around the middle of the year, and then decided after about a month and a half of doing what they were doing, decided to take the beer test, the beer experiment, because he figured that maybe he could just drink a little bit of beer and get away with it, but it didn't work so well. So in July of 1936, he surrendered to the program as much as he could, but he still struggled with the God thing. And it wasn't until actually because he was doing so bad financially, he actually went to try to borrow money from the bank. And it was actually the loan guy at the bank that had a conversation with him, because Paul Stanley went to the guy, and he kind of just spilled out his guts about his whole story and how his drinking and how he's new, how he's finally sober and he's trying to pull his life back together. And it was actually the bank guy that talked to him about his need to really surrender to God. Right? And he talks about that was really what really got him to open up and just surrender to the whole program. Because back then it was totally about God. I mean, they would go to hospital beds back then, and if someone really said they were ready, they'd make them get down on their knees right then and pray. This was an interesting time because there was no Alcoholics Anonymous yet. There was just the Oxford group that they were frequenting, and the alcoholics that were in the Oxford group actually felt that they were different and special, so they formed their own little Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, or I should say alcoholics meetings of the Oxford group, something that the Oxford group didn't necessarily like too much because they didn't think that that alcoholics were any different than them. In fact, one of the things that they called this group, they called themselves the Alcoholic Squadron of the Oxford group. And but that's in 1936. And then in 1937, actually, Paul Stanley's brother came into the picture. Now, Paul Stanley's brother wasn't actually in the lineage, but both of those guys, Paul Stanley, who is in our lineage, he's got a story in the first edition of the Big Book called Trust Freed Me. That's the name of the story. I was a little disappointed to see that it was only 3 or 4 pages. Really elaborate too much on his story, but it was what it was, right? But his brother, Dick Stanley, his story didn't get into the Big Book till the third edition, which was He Needed to Be Shown. That's in the third edition. So I think that's about all I can tell you about Paul Stanley, except in 19, let me just get the, make sure I get the year right, I think it was 1946. Made some notes here. 1947, sorry. 1947, a guy named Paul Martin met Paul Stanley and started to sponsor Paul Martin. So Paul Martin lived in Chicago when I met him. And he got sober in 1947 and passed away last year with 62 years of sobriety. So that's a little bit of time, right? I don't think I'm young enough to have... I didn't start sobriety young enough to ever get 62 years. But all these guys were in some way really connected with the Big Book. Paul Stanley was there when they were writing it and was really involved in that. And Paul Martin was known to be really into the book, and his group was very... very connected. In fact, my sponsor Joe actually went to him and had him take him through the steps at one point. They were doing something interesting in Chicago. They were doing multiple fifth steps, where you would once you finished your inventory, they would send people over to swap inventories with you, swap fifth steps, and they would just line people up. You 5, 6, 7, 10 people would come and they would read some of their inventory and you would read some of your inventory to them. They were really big on swapping inventories. But again, still really book-focused people. Paul Stanley actually was hanging around a boxing gym for most of the time I knew him. I met him a couple times, mainly at retreats, we'd bring these people out to come and lead the weekend for us. And he was older than the rest of the people that were alive in the lineage, but he was the healthiest of all of them. Because he was working out at this boxing gym. And trying to think, what else can I tell you about Paul Martin? I guess that's about it for now. So there's another guy, Gary Brown, in our lineage. And Gary Brown is actually still alive today and lives in Indiana. And he worked with, his sponsor was Paul Martin. Now, Gary Brown, when he had just a few years, started sponsoring my grand sponsor, Don Pritz. Now, Don Pritz, he got sober in 1967. And he actually just passed away in 2005 with 38 years of sobriety. So there was some shifts that happened around that time, because right now the way it's going back now, it's Don Pritz, Gary Brown, Paul Martin, Paul Stanley, Dr. Bob, and then Bill Wilson. So that's the progression of the lineage. I know I just want to say this. I've heard people get up to the podium and puff their chest up and say, my lineage in Alcoholics Anonymous goes all the way back to Bill Wilson. Right? And I thought for a minute when I heard that, and I thought, all of ours does. Right? So don't be too attached to knowing this list. Right? So anyway, Gary Brown only had, I think it was 4 years. I don't remember for sure. I think it was 4 years, and Don Pritz had 2 years at the time. That they were members of the Denver Young People's Group in Denver, Colorado. And they had a convention in Colorado where they had this guy from Canada come out to speak at this convention. And this guy's name was Mac Cheater. Now, Mac Cheater was from a home group called the Golden Slippers in Winnipeg, Canada. Now, they called themselves the Golden Slippers because, as a group, they just had really terrible recovery. None of them got any time together, and it was real obvious that they had really bad recovery. But as a group, they decided they were going to do something different, and they just had a group conscience and decided to change the meeting into a book study. And the basic idea of this book study is they would start at the beginning of the book and just do whatever the big book said to do. When it said pray, we'd pray. When it said write, they'd write. Right? When it said to take some kind of action, they would just do it. And as a group, the whole tone of the group changed. It became a recovered group. And that there's, from what I understand, there's still Golden Slipper meetings in Winnipeg. So anyway, back to Denver. So this guy, Mac Cheaters, did his presentation. He talked about this his group back in Winnipeg. And it got the interest of a bunch of people from the Denver Young People's Group. And there was 14 people got together that decided that they were going to do a workshop, and they were going to keep in contact with Mac Cheater to help him through the process, right? They're just going to bounce questions off him so that they can go through the book just like Mac Cheater talked about. Just doing what the book said, right? Using the book as a guide and stick as close as possible to the book. And there was 14 people in this group. And it's kind of tough to tell the story because I've heard conflicting stories from different people that were involved in the group. But I'm going to just try to stick to what I'm sure of, and that is there's 14 people in the group. That included Don Pritz, my grand sponsor, Gary Brown, his sponsor. It included a guy named Bob Olson, who's still alive today, who lives in Colorado. And also a woman named Lynn Byron. Thank you, Sheldon. Lynn Byron. Do you know how old she is?
No.
I think she's in her 90s right now. She's pretty old. But she's still working with people, and she's actually just recently ordered some Big Book Awakenings from me, just for your information. So she says she likes it. It's because it goes along with what they were doing anyway, right? So there was 14 people in that workshop. 13 people stayed sober the rest of their lives. One person who is a constant slipper named Eddie Durkin. One of the stories I've heard is that he got drunk and passed out in the Colorado winter and froze to death, and obviously never finished the workshop. but the 13 other people stayed sober and continued to carry this message outlined in the Big Book in this way to people all over Colorado. And in fact, they've started conventions called the Fellowship of the Spirit Conference that Don Pritz was very instrumental in getting going, amongst other people. So about 1982, my sponsor met up with Don Pritz and asked Don to be his sponsor. And that was Joe Hawk. And Joe Hawk actually passed away in 2007. It was May the 7th of 2007. So Joe was very, he was a great teacher. He was really good at acquiring information and pulling it all together and laying it back out to people around him. And there was also a lot of influences in Colorado that he had, a lot of Big Book enthusiasts that were very well known around those parts that he knew of. And he'd gone through the steps for the first time with Don. But Don kind of figured that he was the kind that just needed a lot of input to keep him busy while the real stuff, while God was taking care of what was really needing to be taken care of. So when Joe wanted to go through the steps again in the second year, Don suggested that he try doing it with some other people, to pick somebody else to go through. So in Joe's first 5 years, he went through with five of the some of the biggest Big Book people that I'm aware of, and I might not have the whole list right, but at first I know it was Don was the first time. He went through with Frank McGibbon, and Don Coyas, who was an American Indian who was sponsored by Frank McGibbon. He went through with Gary Brown, and there was somebody else, and the name escapes me right now, but who was living around the Pacific Palisades area, Palos Verdes area around Los Angeles, and he moved up north. That guy passed away. The only people that out of that list that are alive today are Don Coyas, an American Indian, Colorado, and Gary Brown, and I guess those are the only two that are alive right now out of those five. So from all of those people, though, Don acquired all of this Big Book information, and he seems to have pieced together the best of what he got of all of them, and which was good for me, because in 1989, when I came into the program, Joe had already gone through the process with all these people. So when I had asked Joe to work with me, you know, I got like the best of everybody, right? Like the first step, the fourth column is sort of Don Pritz's, but the third column is Frank McGibbon's, right? You guys just got it all in one package, right? And each step of the way, everybody had their little tweak all the way down the lineage. Certainly, by the time I put it down on paper, it certainly got tweaked a little bit more. In fact, once it got down on paper, then it was up for everybody's critique, because now everybody knew what I was thinking because I wrote it down. So, but I'll get back to that in a minute. So, that's the basic lineage. Joe was my sponsor. Don Pritz was his sponsor. Gary Brown was Don's sponsor. Paul Martin was Gary's sponsor. Paul Stanley was Paul Martin's sponsor. Dr. Bob was Paul Stanley's sponsor. And Bill Work came to Dr. Bob. So that's the progression. Okay. So in 1989... I was in my first year of recovery, and I just kind of fell onto the meeting because it was the person that I was working with gave me the instruction, because I had gotten to the 10th step. They said, find an 11 step meeting now. That was my instruction for 10 and 11. And I picked up the big book, I'm sorry, the directory for Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, and opened up the book, and just so happened that night there was a meeting called Steps 10, 11, and 12. I figured, okay, that's what I was supposed to look for. So I showed up at the meeting that night, and I never saw a meeting like this, right? Because I was used to these other meetings where everybody was just... talking about whatever, right? And those other meetings that I was going to resembled more unsupervised group therapy than anything else. But this meeting, you couldn't even talk unless you had finished the 9th step. All you could do was ask questions. And the people that were talking weren't talking about being powerless, they were talking about having power, living with power, and they were talking about how they were doing that, and they were talking about prayer and meditation. And there was something different here. I didn't know what it was, but I was really attracted to it because it was much different than what I was hearing. There were some downsides to the meeting that I didn't understand, really. Some things that probably would have made it, or that did make it, a pretty scary meeting for a lot of people. Not so much the people that were regulars there, because they kind of understood what was going on, but when somebody would walk into this meeting for the first time and not really know what they're walking into, right? See, it was a crosstalk meeting, and they'd invite speakers with a lot of time to come in and talk, and then when it was time to share, they would start interrogating them as far as... He's laughing because he saw it. Sheldon was there. They would interrogate them, and sometimes it was a little bloody, right? There was a meditation in the beginning of the meeting and at the end of the meeting. Sometimes at the end of the meeting, when you open your eyes at the end of the meditation, the speaker had slipped out, so he didn't have to talk to anybody. So... you know, I was only glad that I was a newcomer and I wasn't expected to answer anything or say anything. In fact, they didn't even want to hear what I had to say, so I was kind of safe. But so it was interesting times. I'll get to the Big Book Awakening part now. Maybe as soon as this airplane goes by. So back in 1989, I had got my first computer, and I was the only one in my home group that had a computer, right? You know, I remember in the early 90s, I would ask people, I would always do the phone list because I was the only one with a computer, so I put a little column there for email addresses, and I was the only email address on the list. I mean, who needs an email address, right? Right? So when I started working with Joe, he'd have me come over, and this is what it would look like. I'd walk in, I'd sit down, we'd talk for a few minutes, and he'd line up his lifesavers. He'd have this coffee table, and he'd line these lifesavers up in a row, and he'd just start straightening them and do the same thing with his cigarettes. And, you know, and a lot of times he'd actually have his teeth out because he had full dentures, and so it was real a memorable experience. And and then we'd get into the situation, and he'd start rattling off all of these instructions. He'd just lay out all these instructions of what I'm supposed to do before I come back the next week. And it was basically to go through the big book, read the book, and find the questions that are pertinent to me, that stand out. And he said, write the questions in the book. I figured, right, simple enough, right? Find the questions and write them in the book. See, I didn't have a guide at the time to go by. There was a couple things that some people had come up with, but nothing like what we had today. So I had to actually just find the questions and find where they were and mark and write them all in the book. That was the instruction. So I'd come back the next week and he'd say, "Let me see your book." He'd want to make sure that I did the work, I suspect. So he'd look at it and he'd have this funny laugh. He'd go, and I'd say, "What?" So he'd look at the book again and he'd go, "Sheldon probably does it better." I was like, "Oh, it's okay." I didn't understand. He said, so then he'd just go right in and rattle off more instructions. And he'd give them to me so fast that my head would spin. I'd be writing really fast, and I'd come home, and I would actually just type it all into my computer while it was fresh, so I could keep all the instructions straight. I'd come back the following week, and he'd say, "Show me your book." He'd look at my book, and he'd go, I'd say, "What?" Right? I didn't understand. See, what had happened was, other people, when he said write the questions in the book where you see them, other people used highlighters to mark the sentences where there was questions. Other people underlined. Other people did other things. Very few people actually wrote the questions in the book, right? So it all started off by a big mistake. You know, I thought he said write the questions as questions in the book. And he didn't say anything because he just kind of trusted that God will guide everybody the direction they need to go. Right? So initially, the actual writing of the questions was not necessarily a plan that I thought I was just doing what everybody else did. Right? There was no special direction. By the time he'd rattle off all these instructions, though, it had taken up the time that he had blocked out for me. And by the time we were done with that part, there was somebody else standing at the door waiting to come in while I walked out. That's how many people Joe worked with. Right? Just an endless procession of people coming in to go through the book. I remember at the base, most basic form of the Big Book Awakening, it was just a stack of instructions. Because when I was done, I handed this set of instructions to him, and I says, "Here, now you don't have to meet with anybody. You can just hand them the instructions." So then, rolling forward a few years, I'd say 1991, 1992, I had a couple guys that came to me and said they wanted to do what I'm doing, right? It wasn't something that was real popular. I was still going to a lot of the other meetings that I was going to prior to that. And I don't know if you can relate to this, but they didn't like what I was doing or what I was talking about. You know, because I was talking differently than they were. And you probably see that today, right? That when you walk into a meeting where people want to share about the problems of the day and you want to talk about recovery, right? You're not the most popular person in the room. It seems like the most popular people in the room back then were the ones that had the biggest problems and cried the most. Right? And I'm not trying to be insensitive. I'm just saying that, you know, that's what it seemed. That if you talked about recovery, if you talked about actually being recovered and how you do it, people don't seem to like hearing it. It's like they want you to stay sick. I don't know. So ultimately what happened around that time in the beginning, I went to less and less of those kind of meetings and more to the meetings with people that were doing things. And it's just how it worked out. But anyway, I attracted a couple of people that wanted to go through what I was doing. They were curious about what I was saying. And they just wanted, they were curious of what I was doing. And I said, okay, well, let's just get together. I think there was two or three guys that wanted to do it. By the time we had my first meeting in my front room, 14 people showed up. You know, people were bringing friends, and more people said, "Hey, I heard you're doing this. I want to jump in on it?" All right now, there was no guides, no Big Book Awakening, no nothing. Just instructions that I had laid out that I was given, and I'd send everybody home to just with the same instructions: go home, find the questions in the book, and mark them in your book. And we'd come back the following week and go around the room and and talk about the questions that we found. Well, you got 14 people in a room, right? And what I noticed is you're going to get a big variety of questions. And I also saw something else that was interesting, and that is a lot of the questions they seem to reflect more a person's ability to read and comprehend what they're reading. On one end, I had people that were very good readers, right, and could pick up the questions in the book really well and connect it with the paragraphs before and what's coming, what's going to come up, what hasn't come up yet. But they seem to have the strong ability to keep it in third person. And then on the other end of the room, we had some other people that were really bad readers, especially this guy named Richard. Now, Richard was a really nice guy. I liked Richard. Richard didn't really like anybody or think anybody liked him, but I liked Richard. Richard was a security guard. So he had the kind of job that he just sat at a table all day. So he came with more writing than anybody else. There's just no clue where the writing came from because it didn't come out of the Big Book, even though he was reading the Big Book to find the questions. So what had happened was that after a month of this, we hadn't gotten very far in the book because we were just so in so many different directions that I just figured that that's the way it was going to be. That's the way it was. But so it was only about Richard. The whole thing was about Richard. And I didn't sit down and say, I'm going to write a book. I just sat back one day and I says, I got to help Richard. Right? So I started typing all the questions in from my book into my computer for Richard. And I thought that since these other guys in the group were so good at reading comprehension, I asked them just to double check, just to proofread what I wrote for Richard. What had happened, though, is when I passed out all of this stuff for everybody in the group, everybody got on the same page. Everybody was looking at the same questions. Things started moving faster. There seemed to be some kind of a focus, and actually a group personality formed around this, right? That you see over and over again when you do groups. The group forms this personality, and there was a bond with these guys and a purpose, right? We were going to figure this thing out, and we were all of a sudden all on the same questions, and it was all based on what I was typing, so out of my book. Now, I wouldn't say that I'm capable of doing any better of a job at writing these questions from my book into this format. But what had happened was is to have all of these people looking at what was in my mind or what I was thinking and what I had written. Now I'm starting to get critiquing on this, right? Once I put all of this information on paper, then it started to get hammered out. And that started, as I said, about 1991, right? And the workshop finished with pretty much most of the people that started. And some of them are still around the area today and still connected with my home group. And they're all working with others. For the next 10 years, there was this hammering out process that happened. It was I worked with like 2 to 3 people a day, 7 days a week. I had a little inheritance that was supposed to come in, but there was all this other stuff around all of that, so I was only able to get like $1,000 a month out of them, right? But my expenses were low, so I was able to survive doing this, working with all these people, but I started hammering out all of this information through working with others. Now, again, I still hadn't made the decision to start writing a book. I just wanted to clean up what I had written, what I had been doing in that first workshop. And I started giving it to these other people and just going over it and reading it. And I'd start asking right up front, you know, if you see anything that doesn't look right, bring it up to me, right? So the point of that is that I'd like to stress is that the finished product is not just a result of what I was thinking, but a result of a lot of people's input for about a 10-year period. I'd get a phone call from a guy in New York. He says, yeah, we've got this workshop over here, and, you know, we read this question, and we spent the whole meeting, almost an hour, debating on what it meant. Right? Just before the end of the meeting, read the next line, and it explained it. So I thought for a minute, and I says, okay, so I switched them, right? The explanation first, then the question, right? Little simple adjustments, or somebody would say, well, maybe the book doesn't say this, maybe it says this, right? Some of the best people that gave me the best input as far as what the rough spots were really horrible at giving me a right explanation. Right, that was at least who I was interacting with. Okay, it's not a general statement, but the people that I was trusting that could find these rough spots, they were really good at pointing out, hey, this isn't right, right? So I would take that and look at it and just dig in until I found a better explanation, and I would bounce it off other people. In fact, there was that one phrase in the book where it says the spheres really had their music in Bill's story. Remember that? Right. When I actually found where that came from, I started dialing everybody to tell them what I found. They were a little upset that it was 4 a.m, but they were very gracious about it. They said, "That's great, Dan. Call me in the morning." Yeah. Right? Because I just got really excited about finding these little things out and finding these little parts that tweaked the whole thing that just made everything just that much easier to understand. So it just got more hammered out and more hammered out, and what had happened then. Other thing that happened was that Joe Hawk, my sponsor, worked with a guy named Mark Houston in Texas. And they started doing workshops all over the country. And one of the things that they found is, see, they were really good at presenting these step workshops, but then they'd leave, and all you've got is a bunch of people that listen to a couple good talkers. And they found that if they left something for them to do after they left, that it was just enormously of greater benefit. So when they do these workshops, the taper had these on his table, and they could buy these things from the taper. So they could listen to the process, and then they could go back and form little groups and actually do the process. Okay. I know the airport's right over there. So they'd go out to all these different cities, and they would do these workshops, and people were able to hear about the process, and then they'd form little groups and actually be able to do the process. So there's people all over the country, actually all over the world right now, that are doing the Big Book Awakening process. But initially, it started off just a stapled stack of paper. And you know what a stapled stack of paper would look like. You know, just like, what's this? And then eventually it started getting them comb bound, you know, this little, and they still people would look at it and go, oh, what's this? Because it kind of looks, when it looks like that, it looks like it just came off of somebody's printer, right? Which it did, but that's another story. What had happened in 1996, I was a graphic designer, so I kind of knew how to clean it up. I had added another chapter for the 12th step, and another section for the 12th step. So it got bigger. It got to be about 150 pages. But I was using 14-point type, right, which was pretty big, and I didn't realize that it was because I had an 8-inch monitor on my Mac Plus, an 8-inch screen. And you've seen that, remember the Mac Pluses, the little all-in-one? They'd probably be popular right now because now they got the little netbooks, you know. Anyway. But, so what had happened was, now it's 150 pages, I dropped the type style down, the font size to 12 point, and instead of one-sided pages, it made it two-sided pages and perfect bound it, the way you see it today. Now, that might sound like not a big deal, but what I found with that was when people saw something that looked like a professional book, they gave it, it seemed to immediately give it credibility, right? It was like, instead of it's like, oh, what's this? It was, oh, what's this, right? So it was a little change, but it made a big difference because, you know about when I talk about initial attitudes, right, that you get, that a lot of you have experienced, the initial attitudes that when people see you're doing something different than what you normally see in meetings, right? And it's not that we're doing something so much different, right, but it's different than what they're doing in the meetings that are around here for the most part. You've probably all heard it. You get a lot of judgment because you get excited. You get branded all kinds of names, and you can relate. And you get people saying we're trying to change the Big Book, rewrite the Big Book, right? I've heard that. What else? It's all kinds of things I've heard. When all we're really trying to do is just get back to the purity and just stick with what is the book saying, right? And this is actually the first time that I've been asked to do something like this. But it's not the first Big Book Awakening gathering that I've done, because I've done workshops. And I don't know if there's 45 people here. I counted 40 before, but more people walked in. So I think there's 45 or 50 people here. There's workshops that I've done in San Diego with a group down there where 200 people have shown up for the workshop, and everybody there was in the process. Right? There's groups in Australia. I've had the privilege to go out to Australia and do workshops out there. In fact, I went four years in a row they brought me out. And there's a large number of people out there doing it. I couldn't even guess how many, but there was a lot of people there doing it. And people all over the United States. And I send those Big Book Awakenings to, a lot of them go to England. I've sent them to France and Italy and Spain and Germany. And, you know, so people are getting excited about doing this. So, I think that's about all I can think of telling you about it. And I think you might have been more than you needed to know. I don't know, but I know that hopefully that's answered a question. Like, where did all this come from, right? And basically, I get uncomfortable when people look at me and think that it was something that I did. Right, because that doesn't sit right with me, right? You know, it's in the Big Book. It's just in the Big Book, and I think what we've really done is cleared away all of the stuff that's gotten in the way of the Big Book, right? Maybe drop the whole thing down to a grade level or two as well. You know, maybe in the 1930s people were better readers because there wasn't as much electronic distractions and they read more. Because really, the book initially went out by itself to people that had no meetings around them and no sponsors. All they had was a Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And Alcoholics Anonymous spread that way. Right? But I can't help but be touched by the reaction that I've gotten from the people that have gone through this and have had big life changes as a result of just doing what's in the Big Book, right? And, so I just really feel honored that you'd have asked me to come out here and talk about this. And I want to I'll stop there and we'll just take some questions. If anybody has questions that they want to throw out there. And then maybe afterwards we'll have a couple people talk about their experience with it. So thank you first for that. Is there any questions that anybody has?